This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Nuclear disarmament is a noble goal. It's enticing to think of a world without nuclear weapons. But an analyst writing for the Wall Street Journal this week says the way this goal is being pursued today, particularly by the United States under Barack Obama, is extremely dangerous, and it will actually make nuclear warfare more likely. We'll talk about why that is in our first segment. Europe's plans to build a unified European military have really begun to gain some momentum. EU defense ministers are meeting now, creating proposals that will start to be implemented in the next few months. This is quite a significant development for Europe. We're going to talk about why it's important for us to watch closely with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer. How did the natural world come into its present dazzling and beautiful state? Evolutionists say it all happened on its own without design, and one of the most powerful drivers of biological innovation and development has been natural selection, the survival of the fittest. We're going to look at a few examples of how creative and curious their explanations have to get in order to stick with this theory and to use that to explain pretty much everything. And I'll conclude the program by talking about one of the best things that you can do for your son. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. What is the gravest danger facing mankind today? Is it, as some people think, Islamic terrorism? Is it economic turmoil or global warming or climate change? Well, an article in the Wall Street Journal from this past week argues that the gravest danger is actually fast approaching nuclear instability. Most people don't tend to view nuclear warfare as a serious threat, but with Iran continuing to pursue nuclear weapons, with North Korea undertaking nuclear tests, along with the United States disarming its nuclear arsenal, there's actually a lot of evidence that this really is something we need to be concerned about. I have Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques here in the studio to talk about this. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi, good to be here.
So the title of this Wall Street Journal article is The Gathering Nuclear Storm. It's by Mark Halpern, a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. He's the author of several books on international relations. Why don't you start by just giving us a summary of the argument here?
Okay, sure. Yeah, the basic point is just that right now, the possibility of nuclear war is far greater than what most people think it is, and that includes expert analysis, particularly in the United States. President Obama has invested quite a lot of effort into reducing America's arsenals of nuclear weapons. Back in 2009 in Prague, he delivered his very first foreign policy speech, and he said that his goal was to eventually rid the world of nuclear weapons. And it's not just him. Previous U.S. administrations have also worked toward similar goals. And of course, getting to nuclear zero sounds like a really noble reality to strive for. If suddenly all the nuclear weapons were gone, it would mean the world is a far safer place to live in. But the problem is, it's not possible to just snap your fingers and have all the nuclear weapons instantly vanished. In this world as it is, it's a very, very difficult thing to gradually work toward. And the only real way that America can really convince other nations, such as Russia, to reduce their stockpile of nuclear weapons is for the U.S. to cut its own arsenals down. And then you can't be sure that other nations are actually living up to their end of arms reduction deals. So as nice as a nuclear zero world sounds, the process of getting there is actually really, really dangerous. And Mr. Halpern in this article just makes the case that President Obama's drive to get to nuclear zero will soon put the U.S. in a position for the very first time that it's unable to deter a single first strike by Russia and or China. One of the really powerful points that he makes is that the reductions that are now happening to the U.S. arsenals actually encourage the global proliferation of nuclear weapons. And that's because they make less advanced nations believe that there's a possibility that they could catch up and possibly achieve kind of a nuclear parity with the top nuclear nation, like Iran and North Korea that you mentioned there. And it really is a logical argument because at the high point of our arsenal, the U.S. had more than 30,000 nuclear weapons. That seems a little ridiculous. It seems far beyond what any rational actor would really need to keep the global peace. But what an astronomical number like that does is it allows the U.S. to show every other country that they could never have any remote chance of reaching nuclear parity with America, which would mean they might as well not even try and invest the millions and billions, really, that it would take to attempt that. And a huge number like that also basically eliminates the possibility that a power like Russia would attempt a first strike
right
on America.
Yeah, if they did try to take out nuclear installations within the United States, they would never be able to knock all of them out. There would always be some remaining, and so there would always be a high probability of a counterstrike that could be devastating to them. Whereas if you're talking about a nation that's small, that maybe has one nuclear facility, it would be, or maybe just a handful of them, it would actually be feasible for an outside power to eliminate their capacity for a nuclear strike.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And when we had those 30,000 nuclear weapons, it did exactly that for every single country. But at present, though, after many years of asymmetrical reductions, we have 1,750 active nuclear warheads out of a total of 6,970. And that's still a staggering number, but it's smaller than Russia's 1,790 active of their total 7,300. And of course, those are the ones that Russia lets the world know about. You know, there have been many terrifying reports that have emerged showing that the weapons the Russians claim to have destroyed, according to the terms of our reduction agreements, are often still intact and ready to be deployed. I'll just read a quote here from Mr. Halperin on the topic of Russia's deceitfulness in this area. He writes, "According to its own careless or defiant admissions, Russia cheats in virtually every area of nuclear weapons, deploying missiles that by treaty supposedly no longer exist, illegally converting anti-aircraft and ballistic missile defense systems to dual-capability nuclear strike, developing new types of nuclear cruise missiles, and keeping more missiles on alert than allowed, and retaining battlefield tactical nukes." And then he goes on, he says, "Further, in the almost complete absence of its own soft power, Russia frequently hints at nuclear first use. All of this comports with historical Soviet-Russian doctrine and conduct, and is an important element of Putin-esque tactics for reclaiming the near abroad."
Yeah, you know, that first point is just so critical, because anytime you're talking about reduction and disarmament, you're basing the whole premise on the idea that everyone is really actually after the same goal, and that they're not just kind of playing you and saying, well, yeah, you reduce yours and we'll reduce ours and it'll all be fair. The fact that we've seen evidence that that is not being done in good faith, that there is deceit involved, is really proof that that's based on an illusion, isn't it?
It is an illusion, and it's such a dangerous one. And the result of all of this is that it really makes it more likely that Russia or China or some other nation could come to the conclusion that they could take out America's entire nuclear response capacity in a single first strike. And that's a terrifying possibility, that they could even come to that conclusion. I'll just read one more quote here from Halperin's article about what that really means and about the vital importance of America having an arsenal that makes a successful first strike by an aggressor nation impossible to assure. He writes, "Nuclear stability depends, among other things, upon deep reserves that make a successful first strike impossible to assure. The fewer warheads and the higher ratio of warheads to delivery vehicles, the more dangerous and unstable." And then he gives an example. He says, "Consider two nations, each with 10 warheads on each of 10 missiles. One's first strike with 5 warheads tasked per the other's missiles would leave the aggressor with an arsenal sufficient for a counter-value strike against the now disarmed opponent's cities. He goes on, he says, America's deterrent is not now as concentrated as in that illustration, but by placing up to 2/3 of our strategic warheads in just 14 submarines, by consolidating bomber bases, and by entertaining former Defense Secretary William Perry's recommendation to do away with 450 missiles in the land-based leg of the nuclear triad, we are moving that way.
And it seems he's really looking at this from a very pragmatic standpoint and recognizing the reality that there are enemy nations to the United States that want to do us harm and that are actually looking for any advantage that they can gain over this extremely powerful, preponderantly powerful nation with so many advantages in our defense structure and our military structures. And this is a huge one. If they can actually convince the United States to let go of this deterrent capacity that it has had, and to bring it within the realm of something that they would actually be able to take advantage of, then suddenly nuclear warfare doesn't seem like such an outrageous consideration. Especially, like he said, the way that they're talking about these, the way that you hear Russia saber rattling and making these kinds of warnings and threats about a first strike, nuclear strike.
Yes, that is correct. And there's one other thing that makes the possibility of nuclear warfare more likely than ever, and that is that America is seduced by the myth of what's called nuclear sufficiency. And Mr. Halperin does a really good job of explaining what this concept of sufficiency really means. And it's a myth that's been one of the driving forces behind the U.S.'s nuclear reductions for many years. And basically, nuclear sufficiency says if X number of weapons is sufficient to inflict unacceptable costs upon an enemy, then no more than X weapons are needed. But here's what he writes about this. Nuclear reductions are based upon an incorrect understanding of nuclear sufficiency. We don't define sufficiency. The adversary does. And the definition varies according to culture, history, the temperament, sanity, or miscalculation of leadership, domestic politics, forms of government, and other factors, some of which are unknown. For this reason, the much maligned concept of overkill is a major contributor to stability, in that if we have it, an enemy is less likely to calculate that we lack sufficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really dangerous myth that we've been operating under the assumption of. And then he goes on to write what I think is one of the most powerful statements in the article. He says, if our forces are calibrated to sufficiency, and that's really what President Obama has been working toward, and previous administrations as well. If our forces are calibrated to sufficiency, then presumably the most minor degradation will render them insufficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a lot of margin for error there. And also just thinking about that, the fact that the basic assumption is that you know what the enemy's calculus is. You know what's motivating him. You know exactly what he would consider an unsustainable blow and what would be beyond what would be acceptable in terms of the damage that he would sustain if he were to launch a nuclear strike. So there's a lot of assumptions about his thinking and his reasoning, his rationale, when our leaders, America's leaders today and really for quite some time, have proven that they really don't understand the mindset of the enemies of the United States. They've underestimated the animus that those nations have against the United States in so many cases. I think the whole nuclear deal shows that their desire for a good faith effort of negotiation and cooperation, like what we would like to have with Iran, that those values simply aren't shared by the other side. We overestimate the similarity to which they think like we do.
Yeah, and it's an incredibly dangerous miscalculation to say, well, we personally as Americans, we would feel like losing one of our cities to a nuclear bomb would be an unacceptable cost. But in the minds of some of these other nations, we've seen even in the World War II history there with the Soviet Union, they were willing to incur staggering devastation and losses in order to keep on working toward their overall goal. And I think that that's a mindset that we fail to understand to our peril quite often.
What makes this especially important is how many prophecies in the Bible there are that talk about the scale of devastation that we can expect to see in the time ahead. And there's just no question but that nuclear warfare plays a major role in wreaking that kind of devastation. It would be nothing short of nuclear weapons that would create those conditions. And so the fact that nuclear weapons are going to be used is definitely laced throughout those end time prophecies of the Bible. So we can expect to see these weapons being used. The history of mankind shows that we don't tend to make weapons that we don't use.
That's really what makes this article so sobering, I think, is that, you know, the Bible prophecies are very clear about the fact that nuclear warfare is on the horizon. And then this article here just shows how near that could be. Helprin's final assessment sort of says, in a nuclear world, unsentimental and often counterintuitive analysis is necessary. As the genie will not be forced back into the lamp, the heart of the matter is balance and deterrence. But this successful dynamic of 70 years is about to be destroyed. If the trend continues, one or both of Russia and China could consider a first strike feasible. And if that happens, we may see nuclear brinkmanship or worse, in which the United States, startled from sleep and suddenly disabused of the myth of sufficiency, might have to capitulate, allowing totalitarian dictatorships to dominate the world. Current trajectories point in exactly this direction. So it's a really sobering assessment there.
Yeah, powerful stuff. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the gathering nuclear storm. Thanks for your time, Jeremiah.
Great to be with you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Leaders within the European Union have been talking about the need for a single pan-European army for years, for decades, but there have always been checks and breaks holding them back, obstacles that prevent them from proceeding with their plan. Now, though, with several crises plaguing Europe and with Britain having voted this past summer to leave the EU, there is renewed energy propelling plans for a European army forward. To talk about the latest developments, I have via Skype from our office in Britain, trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So right now, the defense ministers of European Union nations are meeting. Can you tell us what's on their agenda, what they're trying to accomplish here?
This kick towards a European military was officially launched on September 11th when Jean-Claude Juncker, the European Commission president, gave his State of the Union speech. And this is where he outlines what EU laws he's going to pursue over the next 12 months. He really set it up by saying Europe is in crisis. For months and months before this, we've had seen various different diplomats and European leaders publish papers, give speeches about Europe needing a military. But he launched the official push to put it into action then on September 11th. Then a couple of weeks ago, European heads of state met in Bratislava to talk about this. And now the defense ministers are talking about it. Their aim is for the European Commission to get together a formal set of proposals and to get that approved by the Commission at a meeting in December. Once that's approved, it's then got to get agreed on by all the European heads of state. And that they aim to have that done by June next year. And so in that State of the Union speech, Jean-Claude Juncker, he set an outline for what he was looking for with these proposals. So the first is he really pushed and called for a European military headquarters. Now, Europe has made, as you mentioned, they've talked about European army in the past, and they've made steps towards this in the past. One of those steps they've made in the past was to come up with European battle groups. These are forces made up of soldiers from several different nations. Now, these have never been used. They're 1,500 strong. They rotate so that somebody's always on duty. They're designed so that they can be called upon with just a few days' notice. And they've never been used. And one of Jean-Claude Juncker's primary goals is to get it so that these are usable and to put this that they've had in theory since 2007 into practice. And one of the big things that they think will help do that is to have a permanent European military headquarters. You'll have somebody who's on the job 24/7, 365 days a year, who is in charge of coordinating European armed missions. Instead of kind of setting up a commander or a command tent every time you have a mission, they'll have one that's always there. And they think with that in place, they'll actually start using these battle groups now and sending them out on missions. So that's one of their first big pushes. The second is that they're pushing for a shared pot of money to be spent on defense procurement projects. So Europe as a whole has some weaknesses. For example, Europe is way behind America when it comes to drones. No European country has really developed a European drone that can compete with things like the Predator and Reaper drone. And so they would aim to address that at the European level. And there's a few other air-to-air refueling, that kind of thing. And so rather than each individual nation trying to fix this problem, they would create a European drone fleet, say, or a European air-to-air refueling fleet that everybody could use. And that would be a very practical way of moving towards this.
Just looking at the overall, say, defense budget, what is the, and I've seen these figures and I just can't recall them off the top of my head, but what is the combined defense budget of EU nations relative to the United States?
That's a good question. It's something that's just changed very recently, because I believe it was about the same. But now that Britain is quitting the EU, that takes a major hit now, because Britain was, I believe, up there with Britain and France were the two top spenders or in the defense spenders in the European Union by quite a long way. So they have really taken a hit from Britain leaving. And so combined with all of these calls for a combined European military, there's a lot of calls now for European nations to spend more on their military to make up for the loss of Britain there.
But there would certainly be projects, defense projects, military projects, weaponization that would not really be practical on a nation-by-nation basis, but could be within reach if they were combining their pot of money and doing this as a collective unit.
Yes, absolutely. And we've seen this already. I mean, the main fighter jet is the Eurofighter Typhoon. And you have that the EADS, the European Defence Conglomerate. So they have already figured this. They already know this. The problem comes, and you saw this with the Eurofighter, the Eurocopter, which is a helicopter they've developed, is that each individual nation starts insisting, okay, well, I want a certain number of jobs created in my country for this project. Mm-hmm. And then this ends up slowing the whole thing down, adding a whole bunch of overheads. So this is more about pushing to simplify and streamline that process than create something new. Because you're right, they do need that, and they have done that in the past. But now they want to do it better.
I would imagine with as much discussion as there has been over the years about a European army, and there have been times where we've actually joked about it, that at times an article will come out, well, there's this new push for an EU army. We're talking about specific plans that are being put into place. We're talking about proposals that should be implementable within 9 months. I mean, this really is taking an idea and turning it into action. And these specific proposals, I'm presuming that within the next few months, we would actually start to see reports of the specifics of what they're proposing. You're talking about general principles, but they should actually become quite tangible in just by December.
That's right. The European defense or the European essentially their foreign minister, Federica Mogherini. She's called it the real stuff. She said that there'll be the first operational results by spring. We've talked about that timetable. I don't think we've ever seen so many calls from so many leaders from such a wide variety of European countries, from Western Europe, Central Europe, Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, all calling for a European military. Now, having said all that, I think it is also important, though, to note the potential roadblocks and the weaknesses of this as well, because we talked about the Bratislava summit that European heads of state went to a week or two ago. And they did launch they did make some significant progress on this push for a European military. At the same time, a lot of people came away from that very same conference very frustrated that European leaders couldn't work together better, very frustrated about the amount of division there. Guy Verhofstadt, who's a leader in the European Parliament, had an article just over the last couple of days talking about how Europe's real crisis is a leadership crisis right now. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly right. And that is, I think, important to keep in mind in the context of discussing this European military. They are making real, tangible progress. But I also think there's a limit to how far it's going to go right now because of that leadership crisis. Mm-hmm. So almost like the European battle groups, I think what we might see is something that sets a headquarters up, sets a lot of things up that don't get utilized to their full potential until that leadership crisis is fixed. And if anything, I could see some of this difficulty in progressing on a European army. Despite all of this will for a European army, I think we'll see some of the same squabbles that we've seen in the past. And that could even intensify this desire for better leadership. So it is a significant push. It's an important push, but there are significant weaknesses there as well.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point to make, the fact that you could well see infrastructure established, important infrastructure, decisions made, policies put in place, and still the gears not cranking the way that they could, and the frustration over that fact actually intensifying that desire for strong leadership to make full use of the machinery that's been put in place. And that will be definitely something that we can watch for. Looking at the specifics that you've seen to this point, say if those who would be skeptical and say, well, this is really more form than substance, what's some of the evidence that you've seen that this really is more significant military integration being discussed here than what the skeptics would think?
Well, one thing that's a great example of what we've just been talking about is something Europe had begun before this latest push, but Jean-Claude Juncker really touched on it in his speech and put it forward, and that was this European Border Guard force. And it's a great example of exactly what we're talking about, because this is a huge deal. It has the authority to deploy inside a European nation without the government's consent. That is a major step. However, it's only 1,000 strong. So you're establishing an important principle, but you're doing it with a pretty impotent force. And it doesn't take much to see how that 1,000, though, at some point could become 10,000, 20,000. And then you're talking about something pretty big. I think also then when you look at terms of this defense cooperation in projects, I think that's something that has huge potential that isn't really being examined right now. So if Europe, when they got involved in Mali, Europe has a big shortage of transport aircraft and logistics, and they had to rely a lot in Mali on the US Air Force for the logistics support there. Now, they want to build at a European level, which they may well do. And then at that point, if any nation in Europe wants to get involved in the Middle East or in North Africa, they will not be able to do that alone. They will have to go to the EU for all of that logistics support for the rides, just to fly the soldiers over there, because it takes a lot to fly all that men and equipment over there. And so once this, and all the same with drones, if there's a drone fleet and no army within Europe owns their own drones, but there's a European drone force, again, just about any time you're ever getting involved in a military conflict, you're doing it now at a European level instead of a national level. And at that point, it only becomes a small step then to Europeanize the military way further and just create an actual de facto European army.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point about just the principles that are being laid down by some of these decisions. You talk about that European Border Guard force, as small as it is, the fact that it would establish the principle of a pan-European force being able to deploy within European nations without the consent of those nations' governments. That is a huge point for those who are advocating this army to have on their side. And it seems like these leaders have to be cognizant of the fact that they are driving the wedge in, and they are opening the door, and they are creating these opportunities to be used at future times. You could easily argue, if you're talking with a leader of an individual country, well, it's only a few people, this isn't really a big deal, and it's for a very specific purpose. Yet the wedge is in there, and if at some future point they needed to expand that dramatically, the principle is already established.
Absolutely, and I think Federica Mogherini herself put it very well, where she said, what we're proposing today isn't a blueprint for a European army. I'm paraphrasing her, but she said, it's not a blueprint for a European army, but it is the beginning of a European army. And that's exactly what it is. It's putting those principles in place. The wider structure will still have to be built, but it's making some of those most important, it's breaking ground on some of those most important developments.
One of the points that Gerald Fleury made in the wake of the Brexit vote this past summer was how much that decision by Britain is going to accelerate these kinds of trends within Europe. In your view, how much did Britain's decision provide the impetus for what we're seeing right now with the respect to the European army?
Yeah, in a huge way. I don't think I have read maybe even a single article on this subject that does not talk about Brexit. Mm-hmm. No, it's a factor in every discussion about this for two main ways. Firstly, Britain was dead against this. There's the former chief of general staff of the Italian army. He said that everyone knew that without London, you couldn't even begin to talk about a common European defense policy. So Britain, when they're a full member of the European Union, they shut down even the discussion. This discussion would not have even been allowed to get this far had Britain been a member of the European Union. And then also, by leaving, Britain created this sense of crisis and this feeling that, wow, Europe is falling apart. We need some big, obvious progress now to show that we're not going backwards, but we're still going forwards. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, that is also behind the push towards the European military. Now, there are still some nations, Ireland probably the most notable example, that are opposed to this. But without Britain in the club, they're going to have a much, much harder time opposing or slowing this down.
It's a much smaller minority.
Exactly. And so it looks, and European leaders are talking about, they're putting in place, I mean, we talk about this principle of putting a principle in place and then coming back to it years later. They're doing that already with the European army, where they're going back to things they put in place to the Lisbon Treaty so they can move forward with this now, even if a few countries like Ireland object. Britain might have stood a chance and did, in fact, manage to stop that in the past. But these smaller countries without Britain just can't do that.
Fascinating stuff. And this is only going to get more interesting in the months ahead. It's a story that we really we appreciate you continuing to bring this to our attention. And you're going to have your work cut out for you as these proposals take more concrete shape and we see them begin to be implemented in 2017. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's working on an article about this latest push for a European army. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks again, Richard. That was great.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The natural world is a wondrous place. It's full of intricate designs and interconnections. And if you believe in a creator, you see evidence all around of fantastic engineering, engineering that makes the greatest minds on earth wonder and marvel. But if you believe that all of this just happened through evolution, you look at all of that evidence quite differently. You see it really as a series of puzzles. How could this have come about on its own without design? And that can lead you to draw some pretty remarkable and curious conclusions. One of the fundamental justifications that evolutionists use to explain these things is natural selection. Now, natural selection is obviously a provable fact in the sense that, say, a dog species that is exposed to cold over time will develop longer hair in order to stay warm. But scientists have found ways to make natural selection the explanation for amazingly complex elements of creation, even new species. To talk about this, I have trumpet writer Chris Eames here via Skype from our office in Jerusalem. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Mr. Hillicker. Good to be here.
It's great to be talking to you. First of all, I have to ask you how things are going for you in Jerusalem. You've been there for, what, a few weeks now? Maybe you can just give us an idea of what you've been up to.
Yeah, that's right. I've been here for about 3 weeks now. It's been great to come back here to Jerusalem. And basically, I've been splitting my time between working on trumpet articles and such half the time, and then actually spending the other half of the time taking the Hebrew Ulpan courses, which I'm not sure if some of the listeners may know about that. It's an intensive Hebrew language training program. I'll be taking that course here over the next few weeks to come as well, just to get a better grasp of the Hebrew language. It's something that's always interested me and has actually helped a lot in the past on archaeology excavations that have happened in Jerusalem here and that I've been able to be a part of.
The idea there is that you would actually be enough of an expert in the language that you'd be able to assist with some of the just handling and managing some of the professional translations of the trumpet.com material into Hebrew.
That's right. Possibly some articles, and definitely the plan is for a lot of the books to be translated into Hebrew. And so the idea with myself personally and with my co-worker here, Brent Nagtegale, is not so much to be actively translating the literature, but just to be proofreading it and making sure it's good to deliver out to the public.
Well, that's very exciting. And that's something that I'm sure that we could talk about that for quite a while. That's what we should have done this interview on, is what's going on over in Jerusalem. I know that a lot of listeners are interested in that, as I am. So we're going to change gears here. We're going to talk about natural selection. I'll mention Chris Eames is not a scientist. He is a budding archaeologist and Hebrew scholar, and he's a man with a very curious mind, and I mean that in every sense of the word. I don't expect this to necessarily convince any hardcore evolutionists out there, but like Chris, I've encountered many phenomenal explanations of various aspects of the physical world over the years, and you've kind of compiled several of these together that really do. I mean, it's kind of comical, some of these instances that you've encountered. Maybe you could just give us an idea of some of the ways that scientists use natural selection to explain our world.
Sure. Well, to begin with, like somewhat you've stated already, evolution in biological science is considered a fact. And a lot of religious people make the mistake sometimes of calling it the theory of evolution in order to convince of our argument. And it's true, it's the theory of evolution, but I was bitten by that myself. And I was told by someone, well, no, it's a fact. The theory about it is how it happens. So the theory of how it happens is natural selection. And that's what I've based my article here today on, and is what we'll talk about today, because there are a lot of theories that go into this evolution that is considered as a fact. It's built on theory, really, a foundation of sand. And science assumes that God can't have created man. Man must have come developed from animals through natural selection. And so it leads man, like you said, to think of all these different ways as to explain why we are the way we are, based on our development through animals, and specifically through apes as our closest ancestor. So a couple of examples, perhaps, that we could look at of how we're different from animals like these apes is, why are we hairless? Why are we essentially hairless when all of our ape ancestors supposed to be covered in fur. What is the difference with us? Now, there are a range
of
different
I have
theories.
To say, though, I'm looking at your image here on Skype, and you do have a very handsome beard, Chris.
Thank you very
Some
much.
Some of us are less hairless than others.
I do lead out with that in my article. There is prevailing thought at the moment that us men will grow beards in order to attract female attention. And when the time comes that there's so many bearded people in the world, we'll start shaving our beards in order to be different and thus again attract female attention. So that's a little bit of a insight into the thinking of why men grow beards and why they don't grow beards.
It's again, all about procreation. It's all about trying to extend your line onto the next generation, where you're basically saying, I'm growing a beard because I like hair on my face.
That's right. Yeah, I'm certainly... not as far as I know, attempting to attract any female attention with it at the moment here. But that's the kind of thinking that has gotten into biological science, is not even the physical appearance of us, how that happened through natural selection, but our thought processes as to why we want to grow beards, how our thought processes are based on natural selection and on evolution. But back to talking about why we as a human species are hairless, essentially, apart from what we've got on our heads, armpits and such. There are a couple of theories about that. Science has wondered if we've taken to the waters partway into the evolutionary journey and lost a lot of that hair and then returned back to land-dwelling creatures in order to develop as hairless orangutans, essentially. And so perhaps we lost our hair through being partial water-dwelling creatures. Another theory that's come out as to why we're so hairless compared to our ape ancestors is perhaps it was warm enough not to need hair. Maybe we just shed it because it was warm enough not to need it. And as you would imagine, there are a lot of holes with these ideas. Why do all our ape relatives, if we can call them that, have such fur on their bodies? And why do we not? And the fact that why do we have so much on our heads when so much specifically located on our heads and we're so hairless on the rest of our body? What's the purpose of having hair on our heads? And science has actually shown that the concentration of hair on the human head is just as much, if not thicker, than with apes. So there's got to be a reason for why we somehow lost this hair on the body, but if anything, developed thicker hair on the head. It just leads to a whole new can of worms that science really has to dance about to try and explain.
Yeah, it's a good basic illustration of the fact that whatever it is that you're looking at, anything that you're looking at, you're having to evaluate kind of through this lens of how did this happen? And there must have been some biological force driving this to appear in the state that it is right now. And so then it's just a matter of reasoning it out and trying to deduce and trying to make sense of that through human reasoning versus saying, okay, well, God put that there. What was the purpose? Why did he do that? And working backward from the standpoint that it makes sense from a design standpoint. Everything is biologically driven.
That's right, and that's what I try and bring out in this article as to maybe there's another way. That's how I put it towards the end of this article. I list out all of these different examples of what science is forced to come out with because they reject any thought of a creator, a designer. And then at the end of my article, I suggest that what if there is another way? What if we were created and designed like what must have happened, for example, with hair on our heads? As pointed out by 1 Corinthians 11, other scriptures that I use, maybe God designed it there as an ornament, as his scripture says. But there's many other examples as to the differences between man and other animals. Another I guess I could bring up is between human females and a certain species of whale. Now, there's actually three mammals in the world that go through basically a menopause, having a long time after living after childbirth. And those mammals are the human female, the orca whale, and the pilot whale. So they're not exactly the closest of relatives there. But of course, science is forced to try and explain this as to why this should be the case. Natural selection should, if it works this way in other animals, it should require that an animal will continue to give birth to children up until the point of death. Natural selection would select something strong like that. So why is it the case then that all these primates don't go through this menopause, keep giving birth to young up until they die? And why do human females not? Why do human females join with pilot whales and orca whales in this matter?
Right. So the way that the primates act in this particular circumstance is what you would expect just looking at things purely from a natural selection standpoint. But these three species that seem unrelated, although I don't know, maybe pilot whales and orca whales are close cousins, but it makes no sense from a natural selection standpoint.
That's right. And science is still trying to understand this fact as to why humans and these two species of whales go through this menopause and why it would benefit the species. And basically no conclusions have been able to be drawn from this, aside from the admittance that it should be theoretically against natural selection to have a longer lifespan without the ability to bear children like this.
So and have they come up with any kind of an answer to this, or do they have any kind of speculation, or is it just that, this doesn't make sense?
One potential answer to it is that perhaps the elder females in these groups act more or less as kind of leaders in the group, some kind of guiding force in the group, the older females in these pods of whales helping to basically lead the groups. And what I bring out in the end of this article is that's almost very similarly true for human females from what the Bible says. God gives them a longer lifespan after giving birth to children so that they can pass on knowledge to the next generation, help out the next generation, as it talks about in Titus 2, because they've got more of a job left for them after giving birth to children. It's not just about childbirth in terms of human females.
So many of these examples that we've just covered, a couple of them, you have a handful of others in this article, but it is really two very contrasting explanations for these basic biological realities, one of which is convoluted, difficult to understand, based completely on speculation, based on our best knowledge of environmental factors, and using this panacea anytime you're dealing with any kind of a situation like this. You just say enough billions of years and it turns out the way that it is today versus what it was way back. There's design, there's a simple explanation. A lot of times you actually have something that you can point to in the Bible that is a clear, basic reason for why it exists and the fact that there was design and engineering behind it, and it all makes sense. I really think that there's something kind of refreshing about this article, looking at these specifics that you have gotten into, because it comes up anytime you watch any kind of nature show, anything that is explaining some amazing aspect of the world around us, how this all just tended to happen. They always throw the billions of years in there and poof, you've got this wonderful majesty in the creation. It is definitely something that I think is worthwhile just spending a little bit of time focusing our attention on.
I'm glad to hear you appreciate it.
All right, we've been talking with trumpet writer Chris Eames. He's written an article called Natural Selection, An Answer to Everything. You can watch for it in the time ahead on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Stay safe over there.
Will do. See you later.
time for today's last word.
Raising rowdy boys into responsible men is difficult. You want to know one of the best things that we can do for our sons? Our children are growing up in a wired world. The Kaiser Family Foundation says children ages 8 to 18 spend an average of 6.5 hours a day with media, television, radio, computers, not including schoolwork, music players, and so on. That's over 45 hours a week. That's also more time than they spend with their parents, which is less than 16 hours, time in physical activity, 10.5 hours, or doing homework, just over 5 hours. Looking at those numbers alone, it's not difficult to see a correlation between increased media use and family breakdown and childhood obesity and declining academic performance. Technology is a strong drug. It grabs young minds. It dominates them. Boys in particular tend to love the stuff, especially video games. Beyond the mere time issue, though, is the content of that media. Studies prove it's hurting our boys. It's our duty as parents to intervene. In her book, Boys Should Be Boys, Meg Meeker writes this: as a pediatrician, I can tell you that disconnecting or strictly limiting and strictly supervising your son's access to electronic media is one of the best things you can do for his emotional, mental, and physical health. Now, this kind of parental control has gotten unpopular in our permissive age, and our children are suffering for it. Think about it. Young people have no built-in sense of right and wrong. They have no natural means of distinguishing something acceptable from something destructive. Young people might know how to use a certain technology, but be unaware of the risks that it poses, and it makes them particularly susceptible to its evil effects. We as parents must be the gatekeepers of our children's minds as we train them how to be responsible for their own minds. It takes time to teach right from wrong and to help them develop the character to hit the off switch or walk away from bad influences. So in the meantime, we need to control the off switch. Our vigilance in our son's media usage can help prevent a multitude of problems from taking root in their lives. Boys tend to be drawn to media violence far more than girls, and there's plenty of media out there to inflame that appetite, but it's a trap we need to steer our sons away from. The American Academy of Pediatrics has repeatedly warned that television violence hurts our children. It's found that boys who watch violent TV turn more aggressive, even with brief exposure, but much more with larger doses. Playing violent video games correlates to even worse antisocial aggression. Meeker cites studies showing that they increase aggressive thoughts, they can increase feelings of anger or hostility, and can raise a boy's blood pressure and heart rate. Video games are increasingly graphic and realistic, and in many of them, the object is to kill people. Professor David Grossman, he's a 24-year Air Force veteran who testified before a senatorial committee on youth violence, he says that the parallels are strong with the techniques that the military uses to prepare men for violent combat. Violent video games desensitize our boys to human suffering and actually condition them to kill. Meeker says this: when the images are bombarded on an 8-year-old brain, a boy can easily shift from believing that a man is supposed to be trustworthy and self-controlled, as you, his father, might have taught him, to believing that real men are cruel and aggressive. Ensuring that our son's model of responsible masculine behavior remains balanced and realistic requires that we strive to limit those false images and provide a good example and solid instruction of what is true and right. The world is filled with dangers, and a lot of them come via the media. Our sons need a strong moral compass in order to navigate this crucial aspect of their lives and to make it to manhood as unscathed as possible. We want to facilitate any use of technology and media that is genuinely good for our boys, that builds right knowledge, and cognitive development and strong character, but we want to draw firm lines on what is going to hurt them. And knowing where to draw those lines, both in quantity and in the content, requires educating ourselves and also asking God for wisdom and discernment. Teach your boy right from wrong. Show him how a real man, like King David says in Psalm 101, verse 3, "I will set no wicked thing before my eyes." Provide a good example and then supplement that with a whole lot of good instruction. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, and Chris Eames. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Mark Twain. Whenever you find that you're on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.